Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 26, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover this week, we're back to a drawing, and it shows President Trump in the White House. Looks like it's at night. He's in a bathrobe. He is looking at a portrait of President Nixon on the wall. And it says, Trump in crisis. The Watergate-sized scandals engulfing the presidency. The main stories and how they were covered. Comey memo triggers new Trump crisis. What happened? Donald Trump's presidency faced its gravest crisis yet with the allegation this week that he asked then-FBI Director James Comey to shut down the federal investigation into Michael Flynn, his former national security advisor. He is a good guy, the president told Comey, according to a leaked memo written by the FBI director immediately after the encounter. I hope you can let this go. That request, which some legal experts say could lead to obstruction of justice charges and possibly impeachment, took place in the Oval Office on the day after Flynn resigned for misleading the administration about his contact with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. In his memo, Comey wrote that Trump sent Vice President Mike Pence and Attorney General Jeff Sessions out of the room before urging the FBI director to drop the investigation. White House officials said Comey's memo was not a truthful or accurate portrayal of the conversation. But in response to growing political pressure, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein named former FBI Director Robert Mueller as a special prosecutor to take over the investigation into whether the Trump campaign colluded with Russia's hacking of the Clinton campaign. Rosenstein said unique circumstances required him to hand off the investigation to a person who exercises a degree of independence from the normal chain of command. Senator John McCain said the scandal was now a Watergate size and scale, while Representative Justin Amash, Republican from Michigan, said the allegations, if true, were grounds for impeachment. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said the country was being tested in unprecedented ways and warned his fellow senators that history is watching. Last week, Trump flatly contradicted his aide's earlier claims that he had fired Comey as a result of a recommendation from the Justice Department. The president told NBC News he was going to fire Comey, whom he described as a showboater, regardless of the recommendation, in part because he believed this Russia thing was a made-up story. When sources close to Comey revealed that Trump had asked for the FBI director's loyalty during a meeting in January, the president tweeted that Comey better hope that there are no tapes of our conversations. What the editorial said. When will Republicans in Congress decide that enough is enough? Asked the New York Times. Trump's attempt to quash a federal investigation into Flynn, one that could still reach into the highest levels of his campaign and administration, constitutes a gross abuse of executive power. It's time for congressional Republicans to finally put the country above party and stop defending Trump. Trump needs to realize how close he is to losing congressional Republican support, said the Wall Street Journal. Weeks of pointless melodrama have halted all the momentum on health care and tax reform legislation, leaving lawmakers exhausted and deeply frustrated. If they decide that Trump looks like a liability to their reelection chances in 2018, they'll drift away and his presidency will sink before his eyes. What the columnist said. Comey's memo isn't a smoking gun. It's a gun without powder, said Greg Jarrett in FoxNews.com. If the attention-seeking G-man really thought Trump was trying to obstruct justice, he was legally required to report it immediately. He didn't, because he knew Trump's vague and ambiguous language wasn't specific enough to constitute obstruction of justice. If the conversation was so innocent, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post, why did Trump order everyone else out of the Oval Office? His attempt to pressure the FBI director to drop an investigation into a top aide became even more sinister when he fired Comey himself over the broader investigation into his campaign. The lawyers can debate whether this satisfies the technical elements of obstruction, but it's pretty clear to the rest of us. Trump's presidency is on the verge of collapse, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Legal scholars say that if Comey's memo is accurate, Trump committed obstruction of justice, one of the charges in Bill Clinton's 1998 impeachment, and the central charge that forced Richard Nixon to resign in 1974. The threat to Trump's presidency is grave. Investigations, once begun, tend to snowball. The special prosecutor was a necessity, said Paige Pate in CNN.com. Now that Trump has evidently tampered with an investigation, fired the FBI director, and pressured Justice Department officials to cover for him, only a totally independent special prosecutor can provide Americans with assurance the full truth will be revealed. Careful what you wish for, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. Special prosecutors set out to find evidence of crimes and often take years to complete their secretive work. The most pressing question about Russia's meddling in our election and whether the Trump campaign colluded in it is what happened. An independent commission like the one that investigated 9/11 would be better suited to answer the question. Trump's loyal base won't give up on him because of the Comey memo, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. As a result, congressional Republicans will keep looking for excuses to defend Trump, but they cannot go on like this indefinitely. If Republicans give up any hope that Trump can successfully govern and decide he's an impediment to their agenda, that'll be the real tipping point. And we follow that with the controversy of the week. Trump, is he unfit for office? After a series of shocking revelations engulfed Donald Trump's presidency this week, said David Brooks in the New York Times, there can no longer be any doubt. Our nation is being led by a child. The common thread linking Trump's sharing of highly classified intelligence with Russia and his firing of FBI Director James Comey is the president's impulsiveness and sheer immaturity. Trump reportedly babbled top-secret information to the Russian officials visiting the Oval Office, not for strategic reasons, but just to impress them, like a 7-year-old boy desperate for the approval of those he admires. He fired Comey because, as he admitted in an interview, he got tired of seeing that showboat on TV talking about the Russia investigation. None of these disastrous decisions was part of a deliberate plan, said Ann Applebaum in WashingtonPost.com. Each one was made because of the president's willful ignorance, impulsiveness, and inexperience. But can anyone really be surprised? Last August, 50 Republican national security experts warned that the ill-informed, thin-skinned Trump lacks the character, values, and experience to lead the nation. Nearly 4 months into this disastrous experiment, it's clear they were right. There is clearly something wrong with Trump, said David Roberts in Vox.com. His chaotic, scandal-plagued few months in office have exposed him as an extreme narcissist, haunted by a gnawing sense of inadequacy, and driven by his hunger for adulation, admiration, and reinforcement for his hypersensitive ego. Denied it, he becomes incredibly vengeful. Trump has no real agenda or core beliefs except a hunger to dominate others. No one can trust him. He is a raging fire of need shaped by a lifetime of entitlement with the emotional maturity and attention span of a six-year-old. To put it more simply, said Andrew Sullivan in nymag.com, the president is flat out off his rocker. Pay no attention to the armchair diagnosers, said Cullen Heroux in thefederalist.com. It's no coincidence that those now speculating aloud about various psychiatric conditions afflicting President Trump, from malignant narcissism to Alzheimer's disease, also loathe him on ideological grounds. Their concern about his mental health rings hollow. As for the speculation that Trump is showing signs of age-related decline, said Tony Schwartz in the Washington Post, I see no difference between the Trump of today and of 30 years ago when I wrote The Art of the Deal for him. Then, as now, he was a desperately needy guy who saw every human encounter as a contest he had to win by any means necessary and damn the consequences. Whatever the state of Trump's mental health, said Ross Douthat in nytimes.com, he just isn't up to the job. Even his inner circle now report a constant struggle to keep him focused on the task at hand and to curb his self-destructive impulses, as if they were stewards for a syphilitic emperor. The 25th Amendment to the Constitution provides a mechanism for removing a president who is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and it's time for Congress to apply that remedy. I agree that Trump is unfit for the presidency, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. But for Washington elites to depose him on such nebulous grounds would enrage the tens of millions of Americans who voted Trump into office. They'd see it, not without justification, as a coup, and the result would be rage and turmoil, the likes of which we have not seen in a while. It was a good week for selling high after President Trump quietly put a sprawling 9-bedroom beachfront estate on the Caribbean island of St. Martin up for sale for $28 million. A local realtor said the property is overpriced by about $10 million. It was a good week for scoops after TV evangelist Rick Joyner predicted that Christian prophets will soon be able to write news stories a week in advance. You don't need to watch the Super Bowl, Joyner told his flock. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. And it was a good week for sologamy, with the news that longtime single people in places like Brooklyn and San Francisco are now marrying themselves in full ceremonies. It means that we are enough, even if we are not partnered with someone else, said Erica Anderson, 37, who recently tied the knot with herself. But it was a bad week for dialing 888-8888. After well-known personal injury attorney Ross Solino filed suit against longtime associate Stephen Barnes to dissolve the nationally known Solino and Barnes law firm. The firm is best known for its corny but catchy jingle in TV and radio ads. And it was a bad week for foul, F-O-W-L, play. After an Indianapolis man trying to protect his 4-year-old from an aggressive Canada goose was issued a ticket for animal cruelty. It was clearly attacking my son, said James McDaniel, who admits to hitting the bird with a wiffle ball bat. And it was a bad week for avocado hand. After a reported rise in injuries resulting from people cutting themselves while trying to open the popular fruit. Doctors say they're seeing a steady stream of people with severe nerve and tendon injuries requiring intricate surgery. And before we move from this page, a boring but important piece. Trump releases tax letter. President Trump's tax lawyers released a letter last week saying that his income tax returns show no income or debt from Russian sources over the past 10 years, quote, with a few exceptions, end quote. Trump made $95 million from the sale of a South Florida mansion to a Russian billionaire in 2008 and received $12.2 million after holding the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow in 2013, according to the letter. The lawyers did not release Trump's actual tax returns, and their letter covers income only from the past decade. It also does not indicate whether Trump received Russian income or loans from entities registered elsewhere. This is an artfully written letter covering a limited time period, said tax expert David K. Johnston. And we take a look at the briefing page. The title this week, Venezuela's Descent into Chaos. The economy is collapsing. Food is scarce. Violent protests rage in the streets. Is Venezuela headed for a rebellion? What is daily life like? It's become a Darwinian struggle for survival. Although Venezuela has more proven oil reserves than Saudi Arabia and was once one of Latin America's wealthiest countries, it is now enduring the world's deepest recession. The economy has shrunk by nearly a third since 2013 when leftist President Nicolas Maduro took over from his mentor, Hugo Chavez. Food imports have plummeted 70%. Supermarket shelves are often empty. And skyrocketing inflation, now about 800%, means that what little food is available is too expensive for many Venezuelans. Throngs wait outside grocery stores for delivery trucks, not knowing whether there will be rice available or just cat food. Fights have broken out in lines. People have been robbed and murdered. These days, you have to put the line above everything, says pharmacist Jaide Mendoza, who saw robbers shoot a man queuing at his drugstore, while others did nothing. You make sure you get what you need, and you don't feel sorry for anyone. Are people going hungry? Nearly 75% of the population lost an average of 19 pounds in the past year because of what locals call the Maduro diet. Across the country, people pick through trash heaps looking for edible scraps to feed their children. To eat, 11-year-old Sergio Jesus Sojas told the Wall Street Journal, I sometimes go to the butcher and I say, Sir, do you have any bones you can give me? Even farmers are short of food. Unable to buy enough seeds, fertilizer, or livestock feed, they've seen much smaller yields than is normal. Often desperate people steal fruits and vegetables from the fields before they're ripe. In some areas, 20% of children under age 5 suffer from chronic malnutrition, and half of those are at risk of dying. The number of women dying in childbirth increased 65% last year, and infant mortality shot up 30%, partly because mothers are undernourished and partly because the healthcare system has broken down. What's happening in healthcare? Hospitals have run out of most medicines and supplies, and patients are expected to bring their own needles, sterile gauze pads, and antibiotics. The lack of antibiotics has caused infection rates to soar, and patients have lost limbs needlessly. Some hospitals have running water for less than an hour a day. The rooms are fetid, and sometimes the patients can't shower, a nurse at Caracas Mental Health Facility told AlJazeera.com. People wet themselves, and we've no diapers. Meanwhile, the malaria outbreak has sickened nearly 250,000 people. How did things get this bad? It started with former President Chavez's socialist Bolivarian Revolution. He funded programs for the poor using the nation's soaring oil revenues. A barrel of crude went from $10 when he took office in 1999 to over $100 when he died of cancer in 2013. Chavez also imposed price controls on a list of consumer products, from rice to toilet paper, and nationalized key industries, seizing oil facilities, factories, and farms owned by wealthy Venezuelans and multinationals. Productivity plunged, foreign investment dried up, and when oil prices nosedived in 2014, the economy collapsed. Hyperinflation has since made the currency all but worthless, and a monthly pension now provides about $10 a month. The crime rate has soared. The country had 92 murders per 100,000 inhabitants last year. In comparison, the U.S. had about 5 homicides per 100,000 people. Angered by the chaos and growing deprivation, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have begun staging daily protests demanding new elections to replace Maduro. How has Maduro responded? By doing whatever it takes to cling to power. He has jailed opponents and shut down the free press. The opposition won a huge majority in the 2015 National Assembly elections, but the Maduro-packed Supreme Court has prevented it from exerting much power. In March, the court issued a ruling all but abolishing the legislature, only to back down a few days later after massive demonstrations and an international outcry. This month, Maduro called for a citizens' assembly to write a new constitution. Half of its 500 delegates will be picked from workers' groups loyal to the ruling Socialist Party, and half will be elected in local contest that could be skewed by the pro-Maduro Electoral College. "You wanted your elections," the president sneered. "Here are your elections." Meanwhile, he has turned out the National Guard to combat the protesters with tear gas, rubber bullets, and truncheons. At least 40 people have been killed in clashes between security forces and demonstrators who have attacked police with rocks and Molotov cocktails. Could a civil war break out? Maduro seems to think so. Worried about the violent uprising, the president is expanding the pro-government armed militia from 100,000 to 500,000 members. At the moment, the threat of a coup is limited because the military's top brass is still with Maduro, who has kept them close. Current or former army officers occupy a third of the cabinet positions, and the army runs key state businesses. But rank-and-file soldiers are suffering like ordinary Venezuelans, and they could turn on the president. Closing political avenues to elections means opening the door to violence, says retired Major General Miguel Rodriguez Torres, Maduro's former interior minister. They are heading toward anarchy in the streets. A narco-dictatorship. The economy may be collapsing, but one business is still booming in Venezuela, the cocaine trade. Under pressure in their homeland, many Colombian drug traffickers have moved their operations to neighboring Venezuela over the past decade, where they found a government and a military happy to welcome them in return for a slice of the profits. The U.S. State Department says more than half of the cocaine produced in Colombia now passes through Venezuela on its way to Mexico, the U.S., and Europe. Two nephews of President Maduro, who were arrested in Haiti in 2015 by the DEA, were found guilty last year of trying to ship nearly 1,800 pounds of cocaine to the U.S. Maduro's vice president, Tarek El Aissami, was hit with U.S. sanctions earlier this year after the Treasury Department declared that he had a significant role in international narcotics trafficking. The Nation, says Venezuelan Bishop Castor Oswaldo Azuaje Perez, is being run by a civilian military narco-dictatorship. Time now for a few columns. One from the U.S. this week. Marble men who fought for slavery. When I saw TV images of crews dismantling the massive statue of Jefferson Davis in New Orleans, said Garrett Epps, I felt a breathless mixture of elation, disorientation, and bitter envy. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, where monumental sculptures of Confederate heroes, Davis, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, still haunt the city like motionless ghosts. We were taught to believe that these marble men who staked their lives and fortunes to fight for chattel slavery were the equals of the nation's founders, and certainly far superior to the likes of Abraham Lincoln. Constructed by defiant Southerners in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, those hulking monuments weren't innocent historical artifacts. They rose over the old Confederacy even as its rebellion was being resurrected in the form of segregation laws, Jim Crow, and lynchings, a legacy of racial hatred that left the region poorer, more violent, less welcoming, less democratic, less healthy, less educated, and less livable. It is not possible to revere the South's defeated leaders and their lost cause and believe that black Americans are equal. Like the statues of Stalin in Eastern Europe and of Saddam in Iraq, the monuments to the Confederacy should come down, all of them. This is from Germany, trusting in Mother Merkel. Angela Merkel has just made a remarkable comeback, said Eva Quadbeck. Last year, the German chancellor was being bombarded with criticism over her decision to welcome more than 1 million refugees from Syria, Afghanistan, and North Africa. Her center-right Christian Democratic Union, CDU, placed a dismal third in elections in her home state of Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, and many people suspected that the migrant crisis would prove to be her undoing. This January, a plausible challenger emerged in the popular Martin Schulz, who had served as president of the European Parliament for 5 years and returned from Brussels to take over the center-left Socialist Democratic Party, the SPD. Schulz initially soared ahead of Merkel in the polls, but the chancellor ignored her critics and kept on governing calmly, and now she's riding high on a triple victory for the CDU in 3 state elections this year, including this week's vote in North Rhine-Westphalia, Germany's most populous state, and a traditional SPD stronghold. In the upcoming national elections for the Bundestag, scheduled for September, Merkel is once again the driving force for her party and the clear favorite to win a 4th four-year term as chancellor. Germans trust her. That's because she has nerves of steel, said Roland Nels in Der Spiegel. As a crisis management expert in a crisis-stricken world, she exudes competence and unaffected pragmatism. Merkel, 62, lacks big ideas or major reform projects, but she doesn't need them. Voters are happy to let Mother Merkel quietly solve whatever problems the world throws at her. The Euro crisis, the refugee surge, Russia, Turkey, President Trump. She manages to remove the drama from every dramatic event. And she's similarly low-key during election season. In fact, her preferred method of campaigning is just governing the country. She doesn't let poll numbers make her crazy, but simply sees her business through. So far, that has worked, said The Guardian in an editorial. The migrant crisis has abated as a defining political concern, and the German economy is growing, so voters don't see the need for a change. Of course, another influx of refugees or another major terrorist attack could upend the current consensus. Then again, such an event could also remind voters of the safe pair of hands they have in Merkel. The rest of the European Union is counting on Germany to re-elect her. Merkel has a rare ability to communicate well with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and unlike some German leaders, she's not afraid to cross him. At a recent meeting, she urged Putin to stop his war in eastern Ukraine and safeguard LGBT people in Chechnya. Just as important, she can stand up to President Trump, who is said to have asked her 10 times for a separate trade pact with Germany. She has replied 10 times that all deals must go through the EU. This quality of leadership is precisely what Europe needs. In this international column from North Korea, missile breakthrough scares the South. North Korea's nuclear missile program is accelerating much faster than expected, said Yi Yong-ing. The dictatorship last week launched a new strategic ballistic missile, the Hwasong-12, which landed some 490 miles away in the sea west of Japan. The missile flew far higher than previous projectiles tested by the regime, at one point reaching an altitude of nearly 1,300 miles, suggesting the North is edging closer to developing an intercontinental ballistic missile that could hit the U.S. mainland. If Hwasong-12 had been fired at a normal rather than a high trajectory, it could have traveled nearly 2,800 miles. America's military bases on Guam, 2,110 miles away, would be within the strike zone. North Korean tyrant Kim Jong-un still has to overcome a big scientific hurdle in his push for an ICBM, said the Mainichi in Japan in an editorial. Experts think the regime might have a nuclear warhead small enough to be mounted on a missile, but don't believe that warhead could survive the fiery reentry from space into Earth's atmosphere. Still, it's likely only a matter of time before the North develops the right technology. The launch was clearly a challenge to the new South Korean leadership, said Dong Ah Ilbo. It came just 4 days after the left-leaning Moon Jae-in was sworn in as president, following a campaign in which he pledged to abandon his predecessor's hard line toward North Korea and to review the deployment of a U.S. missile defense system, THAAD, on South Korean soil. Kim has also thumbed his nose at U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping, who are both trying to bring Pyongyang to heel. The test seemed timed to cause maximum embarrassment to these leaders, coming as the U.S. aircraft carrier Carl Vinson was engaged in a joint U.S.-South Korean military drill, and on the very day that China kicked off a summit promoting a massive new international infrastructure initiative. Moon called the launch a grave act of provocation and said his planned opening of talks with Kim would only be possible if the North changes its attitude. But he'd do better to scrap the idea of talks altogether and make the deployment of THAAD a done deal. Moon also needs to completely rethink our defense strategy, said Chosum Ilbo. The Americans have promised to protect South Korea, but if the North gets the technology to strike New York, the pledge will only be a piece of paper. Imagine Kim threatening to flatten Los Angeles unless the U.S. pulled all troops out of South Korea. Those soldiers would surely be on the next ship out. That's only one scenario. Just as bad would be a preemptive U.S. strike on the North. Tens of thousands of South Koreans would die in Kim's inevitable counterattack. Moon should consider stationing U.S. nuclear weapons on South Korean soil or developing our own. Our last word article this week takes us in a very non-political direction, maybe as a little relief for us. It's called The Last of the Master Wig Makers. Intricate, high-quality wigs made from real human hair are increasingly in demand, said reporter Annie Coryell. But the artisans who make them are a vanishing breed. Nicholas Piazza keeps 600 pounds of hair in his Staten Island garage. He stores it in plastic bins and cardboard boxes opposite the fishing supplies. Got grays, got browns, got blondes, he said. Got everything. Inside one bin, shiny brown bundles nestled around one another like snakes. He picked two thick braids and lifted them from the bin. Uncoiled, they were 3 feet long and nearly reached the ground. This is all Russian hair cut right off people's heads, Piazza said. Piazza, 69, is the grandson of Sicilian immigrants, the son of a detective, a tournament fisherman. He does not look like a man who would have an exotic hair collection in his garage. But for decades, Piazza was one of the most sought-after wig makers in New York City. He made custom wigs and hair pieces for Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, Brooke Astor, and Lena Horne at Kenneth Hair Salon. He also made the closest thing the world has seen to mermaid hair, creating the long tresses Daryl Hannah wore in Splash. Much of his hair came from this stash, which was sourced from around the world and eventually outgrew his studio. I couldn't close my closets, he said. I had more hair than I knew what to do with. Piazza is one of the last old-world wig makers in New York City. Men and women trade mostly by Italian and Jewish immigrants in the centuries-old trade of hand-tying wigs, a fussy affair that, on the patient spectrum, falls somewhere between tailoring a jacket and counting the stars. These are not the hot pink bobs at Halloween stores. They are made from human hair and have intricate hairlines that blend into the skin. To make one requires weaving hair, a few strands at a time, to a lace mesh cap with a small needle, a process known as ventilating. Ventilating a lace wig, which may have as many as 150,000 knots at its roots, takes about 40 hours. For a quarter century, Piazza had a studio on 57th Street in Manhattan, once the hub of high-end hair, along with master wig makers such as Bob Kelly, who for three decades made wigs for Saturday Night Live and died in 2011, and Rafael Molica, who long ago moved his atelier to the Upper East Side. These days, Piazza rents a few rooms in an unmarked salon in Midtown, where he moved when his old building became a luxury high-rise and where he works just 3 days a week, mainly doing maintenance on his clients' wigs, which start at $3,850. I'm done, he said, just coasting. This may appear to be yet another case of an antiquated craft disappearing from New York, one artisan at a time. But wigs are far from being swept into the past. The demand, it turns out, hasn't been as high as it is now since the wig craze of the late 1960s and early 70s, when Piazza and his fellow wig makers entered the field. Wigs are part of the boom in the human hair trade that began with extensions. According to anthropologist Emma Tarlow, author of Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair, hair extensions reignited a frenzied global trade in hair in the early 1990s. Last year, human hair imports to the United States were valued at $685.3 million, according to the Census Bureau, up from $51.6 million in 1992. Hair, human, synthetic, animal, and sometimes secretly a mix of all three, has become a billion-dollar industry, and as Chris Rock explored in his 2009 documentary, Good Hair, the driving force is the African-American market, which has embraced wigs along with extensions and weaves. It began with celebrities wearing lace wigs, the term of art. Beyoncé, Brandy, the Kardashians, Nicki Minaj, and it's difficult to think of bigger movers in the market. It's the cool thing now, whereas before it was something that everyone was trying to hide, said Hadia Barbell, who was Wendy Williams' personal wig stylist and now has her own line of wigs. There are only about 200 trained custom wig makers in the country today, and the majority work in theater, film, and television, said Michael Meyer, the director of the Wig and Makeup Design Program at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, one of the country's only programs for custom wig making. There are people who take an online class watching YouTube videos, he said, but it's a far cry from the people who have been trained and whose work can withstand an HD camera. One measure of a good wig is its hairline. It's the most difficult thing to imitate, which is why a lot of wigs tend to have bangs. To achieve a naturalistic look, wig makers stitch hair individually at the hairline, often even adding baby hair. Another mark of a superior wig is the quality of the hair. Hair of the kind Piazza has in his garage, long, European, and Remy, which means cut from one head, lined up roots to ends, is the most valuable. It is $4,000 per kilogram, about 2.2 pounds, roughly the going rate of truffles. High-grade Indian hair sells for $2,000 per kilogram, and that is where things get strange. Hair is unregulated, a largely hidden economy open to abuse. There are a whole lot of people living off of hair, Tarlow, the anthropologist, said. Wig makers are only one stop in a long supply chain. Merchants scour the earth looking for hair, which they buy from peddlers who travel, usually alone, through poor remote regions. In Myanmar, villagers untangle hairballs that will be sold to make extensions. In La Parada, a Colombian border town, hair stands recently appeared for women who enter the country from crisis-stricken Venezuela to sell their hair. There is a ban on the international sale of skeletal remains, but human hair is treated like any other raw material, say hardwood or textiles. It is delivered to the customer by courier, its provenance unverifiable. By the end of the 1960s, the United States was the biggest importer of hair, re-exporting it to more than 60 countries. Hair was marketed even to men, even those who weren't bald. Men were encouraged to wear fake mustaches and mutton chops, which Playboy magazine referred to as short-order shrubbery. Soldiers who were off-duty wore wigs over their buzz cuts. Piazza apprenticed himself to a German wig maker after hairdressing school, then went to work for Eni of Italy under Ernesto Caporelli. He started working for Kenneth Battelle in 1973, and Battelle invited him to start a wig business under the Kenneth Salon name in 1979. As the wig craze faded, Piazza diversified. He made falls, slides, clip-ons, topknots, and toupees, a mustache for an open coffin funeral. In 1976, he said, he was called in to make an emergency merkin for a penthouse model who didn't have enough coverage. He made a line of hair ornaments that appeared in Vogue and looked suspiciously like fishing lures. And before long, Piazza began hunting for hair. When Kenneth first put me in business, it was very difficult to find European hair in this country, Piazza said. Everyone always said the finest hair comes from Italy. So he got a list of hair suppliers from the Italian Trade Commission, and for the next several summers flew to Italy. I'd grab a suitcase with like two t-shirts and a pair of jeans, and I'd come home with about 80 pounds of hair, he said. Soon hairdressers and other wig makers started requesting his services. They'd say, "Pick me up a couple pounds. I don't care if you make a few dollars. You've got good hair." So all of a sudden, I was a hair dealer. Standing in Piazza's garage among boxes and boxes of hair, I couldn't help wondering whether the hair, harvested decades ago, hadn't started to smell. "Do you smell anything?" Piazza asked, handing me a braid. The hair was clean and soft and had a faint medicinal scent. Before I could answer, he announced, "Mothballs." "Sometimes someone will come in and say, 'I smell like mothballs.'" He smiled and took the blame. "I didn't wash it good enough," and I'll say, "It's your imagination. It'll come out." Rafael Molica will tell you he is the last wig maker. He will tell you loudly. He will shout and wave his arms and dismiss his competitors, even the deceased one. That hairpiece finagler. "I'm the only wig maker who can make a wig from start to finish on earth, all by myself. If anyone thinks otherwise, I accept," he shouted, standing in his 84th Street atelier. "We can go into a room, bring our fabric, our hair, our ventilating needles, and we can make a wig." Malika, who goes by Rafa and Ralph, was born 71 years ago in Sicily and grew up in Astoria, Queens. His wigs start at about $5,000 and are known as Ralph's. They are so popular in international Orthodox Jewish communities that an imposter has been making imitations that he advertises around Israel, trading on Malika's reputation. "He's a worthless scurve," said Malika, showing me a flyer for the so-called Ralph wig collection. "The real Malika is the one who gets a call when they fall apart." Celebrity culture is credited with, or blamed for, the sudden popularity of wigs. But Hadia Barbell, the former wig stylist on Wendy Williams' talk show, said the real instigator was technology. Celebrities had always worn extra hair. But in the 2000s, high-definition cameras created the need for a more convincing illusion. "We really had to make it look like it was coming out of her scalp," she said of Williams, who is vocal about her love for wigs. "We had to perfect the hairlines and balance it, add denseness, take away fullness. Like Tokyo Styles, who has worked with Lil' Kim and Rihanna, Barbell became a part of the new phenomenon, the celebrity wig stylist. The wigs in her line, Araya, run from $750 to $3,000. "I started converting my clients from weaves to wigs," said Barbell, noting that wigs were the latest development in the so-called natural hair movement, which encourages black women to forgo harsh chemical treatments like relaxers or perms. It shouldn't be surprising, given the abundance of raw hair, that black women are also hand-knotting their own wigs. Stephanie Park, the general manager of Apollo Beautyland in Harlem, said sales for wigs were down at the hair supply store during the winter when they usually peaked. People are doing it themselves, she said. People are getting crafty. They are learning the once rarefied art of wig making. Whereas in the past, apprentices had to sweep workshops and learn to sort hair for months before they could touch a ventilating needle, now people can simply watch YouTube. Hi, you guys. This is Jackie, says the voice on a video from 2013. You only see Jackie's hands, a purple towel, and a styrofoam head form with lace mesh and a wig in progress. Today's tutorial is ventilating a wig, she says. This is my little wig head. Its nickname is Wigna. For the next 11 minutes, Jackie demonstrates the ins and outs of weaving hair to lace. Grab the hair, pull, let it engage, and then, like so, she says. The video has nearly 500,000 views. So there you go. I hope you like it, she says. Very simple, very easy. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times. We've run a little long with our regular features this week, so we'll go on to the Talking Points page. Sessions, the return of the drug war. Jeff Sessions is staging a devastating revival of the war on drugs, said Kara Gulch and Mark Maurer in TheHill.com. The Attorney General last week instructed federal prosecutors to charge defendants with the most serious provable offenses, carrying the stiffest penalties, including mandatory minimum sentences. It's a flashback to the 1980s and 90s when the crack epidemic fueled draconian policies that imprisoned millions, ruined lives, and blighted communities of color. Because of those policies, half of all federal inmates are primarily nonviolent, low-level drug offenders. More inmates are serving life sentences without parole for drug crimes than for murder. The Obama administration rolled back mandatory minimums and focused on violent crimes, a policy that won bipartisan support, eased prison crowding, and stressed treatment over punishment. Now Sessions threatens to undo years of progress while exacerbating a racial disparity that plagues every level of the criminal justice system. Sessions put that law and order twang back into the Justice Department, said Cheryl Chumley in the Washington Times. Liberals squeal about the inherent racism of Sessions' order, but that's just a partisan smokescreen to justify a soft-on-crime approach. Black, white, Hispanic, if you're involved in drugs, simply choose now to quit. Sessions is merely applying the law, said the Washington Examiner in an editorial. These reforms come at the right time. 20 million Americans use illegal drugs, sapping billions from the economy. While after a two-decade decline, violent crime rose in 35 of America's 45 largest cities over the past 2 years. The rule of law is a prerequisite of a civilized society. Lenient sentencing is not. The U.S. definitely has a serious drug problem, said Ruth Ann Daly in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. But it won't be solved by locking people up for decades. To justify his crackdown, Sessions claimed that the drug trade is dangerous and violent. But while drug use has soared, violent crime rates remain far lower than they were 20 years ago, despite a recent uptick in some cities. The war on drugs has been a complete failure, said Kyle Samin in TheFederalist.com. It's also led to a lot of big government overreach, which is not conservative. In dealing with addiction, most cities, states, and rural communities have come to realize that treatment and counseling are more effective than jailing people. Prohibition didn't work in the 1920s, and it won't work now. And we'll do some shorter notes. Hundreds of thousands of Christians are fleeing the violence, persecution, and chaos of the Middle East. By 2025, Christians are expected to represent just over 3% of the region's population, down from 4.2% in 2010. In 1910, the figure was 13.6%. The name Caitlyn plummeted in popularity in 2016 after Caitlyn Jenner, formerly known as Bruce Jenner, announced her new name and gender. All four versions of the name, different spellings, fell out of the top 1,000 of Social Security's annual list of most popular monikers for newborns. For the first time in recorded history, more than half, 54% of American women ages 25 to 29, are childless, according to the U.S. Census Fertility Report. A record 31% of women ages 30 to 34 also haven't given birth. The average base salary for college graduates has soared to its highest level in at least a decade, $49,785 a year. Adjusted for inflation, today's starting salaries are 14% higher than those of students who graduated in 2007, shortly before the start of the Great Recession. And in the poll watch, just 29% of Americans say they approve of President Trump's decision to fire FBI James Comey, including 58% of Republicans and 9% of Democrats. 38% do not approve of the decision. 32% aren't sure. And we'll have to leave it at that because we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.